Chapter 11. Love Letters. Marcus and Majid began writing letters to each other. It was Joyce who started it, by looking in Irie's address book, and, after March 1991, letters began to pass back and forward regularly. Between them, they wrote thousands of words, and because Marcus made copies of all his letters, Irie had to file them for him. She made two files. The first said, from Marcus to Majid. The second said, from Majid to Marcus. Occasionally, she would quietly put a letter in her pocket and take it home. But what she read did not bring her joy. Instead, it made her jealous because it was clear that Marcus was now more interested in teaching Majid than her. Majid and Marcus. It even sounded good. It is as if I had always known you, Majid. You think like me. I like that. We have a meeting of minds. Marcus. They wrote long paragraphs about genes and cancer and changes in medicine. They discussed their plans for the future. Marcus wanted Majid to come to England as soon as possible. He was even offering to pay so that Majid could go to university at Oxford or Cambridge and train to become a lawyer. Marcus needed Majid to fight the animal rights people so that he could continue with his mouse experiments, or future mouse, as he called them. But there was one letter from Marcus in particular that most hurt Irie. Things around here are the same, except my files are now very well ordered, thanks to Irie. You'll like her. She's an intelligent girl, and she has the most enormous breasts. But sadly, I don't think she will ever become a scientist, because she doesn't understand the ideas. She could try medicine, maybe, but I don't really think she's good enough for it. I think she should study dentistry. She can fix her own teeth, at least. It's a good job, but not good enough for you. Irie cried for a little while after she read this, but she was like her mother and father. She turned the bad into good. Right, she thought. I'll be a dentist. Dentistry. Right. Meanwhile, Joyce was trying to help Millat with his problems with white women, and there were many. All women, black ones, brown ones, and white ones, wanted Millat. They gave him phone numbers, crossed crowded bars to buy him drinks, and followed him home. Maybe it was his beautiful chocolate brown eyes, or thick black hair. Who knew? But, as the Americans say, you either got it or you ain't. And Millat had buckets of it. But strangely, Millat's girlfriends were usually white and middle class, age 15 to 28, and living around West Hampstead. This did not worry him at first. Most of the girls at Glenard Oak were like this, and as Millat was the only boy there worth having sex with, he was going to have it with most of them. Right at the moment, he was having sex with Karina Kane, and he was enjoying it so much that he was only sleeping with three other women. And anyway, Karina Kane was different. It was not just sex. He liked her and she liked him, and she looked after him. He looked after her too, in his own way. Sometimes he even brought her flowers. The relationship was good, and he was happier than usual. Except that Kevin did not see it that way. One evening, after Karina had driven Millat to a Kevin meeting, Brother Hifan and Brother Tyrone crossed Kilburn Town Hall to talk to him. They gave him a leaflet called Who is Truly Free? The Sisters of Kevin, or The Sisters of London. Millat thanked them and put the leaflet in his pocket. How was that leaflet? They asked him the next week. Was it a good read, Brother Millat? Millat had not had time to read it, but he could see that it mattered to Brother Tyrone and Brother Hifan, so he said that he had, and that he'd enjoyed it. The next week, he made some time to read the leaflet. He felt strange afterwards. In 3 short days, Karina Kane, a lovely girl who made him feel happy, had pissed him off more than in the whole year they had been having sex, though he did not know why. "Is it becoming clearer?" the brothers asked him the next week. "Yeah, man," said Milat, with a nod and a smile. The brothers looked happy, and Milat was glad to see that they looked pleased. They both wore dark suits, and he felt like he was in a James Bond film. "Anyway, I've got to go," Milat said. "My girl's waiting for me." Brother Tyrone looked disappointed at that. Just before Milat left, he put another leaflet in his hand. "You could be a great leader of men, Milat," Brother Tyrone said, looking at him, and then at Karina Kane, her small breasts showing under her t-shirt as she looked over the car door at Milat. "But at the moment, you are half the man. Allah needs the whole man." As he got in the car, Milat noticed how much of her body Karina was showing. Her t-shirt looked shorter, and he could see an inch of her bare stomach. He read the next leaflet and became more aware of what she wore and the way other men looked at her. And when he spoke about it, she said, "Oh, I hate that. All those dirty old men." But it seemed to Milat that she wanted men to look at her, that she was, as the leaflet said, selling herself to a man's stare. The more he thought about it, the more it pissed him off. Why couldn't she cover up? "I can't respect you," he told her finally, "until you respect yourself." She said that she did respect herself, but Milat could not believe her, which was strange because he had never known Karina Kane to lie. Karina began to cry. She said she did not know what was happening to him. "The problem is," thought Milat, "neither do I." A few days later, he called her and finished their relationship. He continued to have sex with the other 3 girls because he did not care about them, but Karina Kane was his love, and he felt that she should cover up so that other men did not stare at her. About 6 hours after making the call, Milat had arrived at the Chalfins, very drunk and upset. He destroyed Oscar's toys and threw the coffee machine across the room. Then he did what Joyce had been waiting for these last 12 months. He asked for her advice. She told him that maybe he did not like himself, or perhaps he wanted to have whiter babies, or did he know that she had read that 90% of Muslims did this or that. But he must not worry, she told him. She had found him a good counsellor that he could go and talk to, and she would pay for it. Years later, Milat would remember a girl called Karina something or another who he had liked, and she had liked him and made him laugh and looked after him, and in his own way, he had looked after her too. But she seemed very distant now, and that was that. There was trouble at the Joneses. Irie was about to become the first Bowden Jones to enter a university. She wanted to study dentistry, which everyone was happy about, but she also wanted to take a year off first to go to India and Africa. She wanted her parents to let her do this and to help her with money if possible. But Clara said no, that she did not want her daughter to go far away to study poor black people. On the 25th of October 1991 at 1 a.m, Irie decided to go into battle. She knew that her mother was most easy to persuade when she was in bed. She always spoke slowly and strangely then, like a child, and usually she said yes to anything, money, a new bike, even a party. Irie opened the bedroom door, and light came into the room from the hall.
"Irie? What? It's the middle of the night. Go back to bed," said Clara in her strange night voice. "Bloody hell, it's 1 in the morning, love," Archie said, turning away.
Some of us have got to work tomorrow.
I want to talk to Mum, said Irie, walking to the end of the bed. She won't talk to me during the day, so I have to do this.
Irie, please, I'm tired. I'm trying to get some sleep, said her mother.
I don't just want a year off, Irie said. I need one. I'm young. I want some experiences. I've lived in Willesden all my life. Everyone's the same here. I want to go and see people of the world. That's what Joshua is doing, and his parents are helping him.
Well, we can't afford it, said Archie. We haven't all got jobs in science, have we?
I don't care about the money. I'll get a job. But I want you to be happy for me. I don't want to go away and spend every day thinking you're angry with me.
Mum, please will you sit up and talk to me?
I don't want you to go, replied Clara. If you want to stare at black people, you can stare at me for 6 months. You'll get yourself killed out there.
Now, very angry, Irie walked quickly round to Clara's side of the bed.
Why can't you sit up properly and drop that stupid little girl's voice?
In the darkness, Irie kicked over a glass of water and then screamed as she felt something bite her toe.
Ow!
She looked down to where the pain was and saw a set of front teeth under her toe.
What in the hell are they?
But even as she said it, Irie was putting two and two together. The strange midnight voice, the perfect daytime straightness and whiteness. Clara hurriedly stretched her hand to the floor and pulled her teeth from Irie's foot. Then put them on the bedside table.
Happy?
Clara said angrily. She had never chosen not to tell Irie. There just never seemed to be a good time. But Irie was 16. And to her, this did feel like a choice. Another choice in a long list of her parents' lies and secrets. All that history you were never told about. Archie's leg, a photo of strange white Grandpa Durham, a mad wife called Ophelia.
Well, don't look so shocked, love, said Archie. It's just some bloody teeth. It's not the end of the world.
But it was, in a way. She'd had enough. She was tired of not hearing the whole truth, and she was going back to where she began. She walked back into her bedroom, packed her schoolwork and some clothes, and put a heavy coat on over her nightdress. She thought about the Chalfins for a half a second, but she already knew there were no answers there, only more places to escape. Irie knew where she had to go, where the N17 bus would take her, through 47 bus stops before she reached it.
My God, said Hortense Bowden several hours later, her eyes half closed at the front door. Irie Ambrosia Jones, is that you?